ready to listen to another episode of Hacker Voice Radio, your independent free speech media source. Radio episode 57 on the 9th of November 2005. And Hacker Voice Radio welcomes Iron Geek.
Hello.
Hello, everybody.
All the way from the US. Now, we might slightly have some sound problems during the episode. Hopefully, not too many. Hopefully, not too much. But, yeah, I think we're ready to go.
Let's do it.
Yeah. So, yeah, just a general introduction. Iron Geek is famous for producing Flash tutorials on his website. Am I correct?
That's probably the number one thing people come to my site for.
Yeah.
I actually spend more time on the text articles, but it's the Flash articles, or the Flash tutorials that people seem to be most interested in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's one of the reasons why you're here, and one of the reasons why I go to your site most of the time is to check out what kind of new Flash tutorials you've done. And also the text tutorials are also quite good, and they do come in useful. So I think we'll take rounds in asking you a few questions, and then we can go into a new section, and we'll see how it goes. So I'll take this opportunity to introduce Ionix to you. I know that you've already met, so if you want to shoot off with a few questions, and then we'll move it onto the planet, and then we'll come back to me.
All right. I don't know that we've met, but we've had some correspondence over email.
Well, that's what I meant.
Conversed over email a bit.
Yeah.
RIP's met.
Yeah.
Okay. We're going to start off with... what is it... how do you choose what you make a video tutorial of, or how do you choose what goes into the, you know, the text tutorials?
Like, basically, whatever interests me at the time. Sometimes I'm reading a book. Like, I was reading a book recently on open source security tools, and I thought, yeah, maybe it's about time I do a security tutorial on Nessus. Or someone on like Benware forums will say something along the lines of information on sniffing voice over IP, and I'll look into it and write something up or make a video tutorial. A lot of times I'll just go out there and find a new tool I thought was really useful, and I'll show how to use it. That's pretty much how I decide what to do. It's whatever strikes my fancy at the time, or whatever people keep requesting. Enough people keep requesting one particular tool be shown, I'll generally do it. Nmap has probably been the most popular one so far.
Which one?
Nmap.
Oh, the Nmap tutorial. Yeah, those are definitely very good. Very good. Personally, I liked the cracking WEP using Auditor tutorial.
Yeah, so did I. I was just about to mention that.
That was someone else's, though. That one, I think, was... Oh, guys at Crime Machine, perhaps? Someone else did that one.
Oh, yeah.
I did a few tutorials on... on war driving stuff, but one was just a basic intro to a few of the tools, and the other one was how to parse the RFMon dumps in Etherrail, dsniff, or Etercap.
Yep.
And that was part of Droops' last Informonicon TV episode.
Very, very cool.
Yeah, so... let's do this professionally, and I don't know, do you have any more questions so we can pass it on to Planet, because I'm dying.
No, you move on.
Planet, do you want to...
Sure. I was just wondering, how long on average it takes you to produce each of these Flash video tutorials?
On average, I'll go ahead and say, well, if I was putting in hours of work, I'll say probably maybe about 5 hours of work. That's not including research. But a lot of times what I'll do is I'll do part of it one day, like do the video captures. Then when I have time on a different day, I'll do the narration. And then on a final day, I might cut it all together. Well, actually, generally, I cut it all together first, then do the narration. And then I find out later on that I didn't actually record enough video time to say everything I need to say to get the idea across.
Yeah.
But that's... Generally, it takes me a couple days to produce it real time, but actual time, you know, doing the work, it's usually less than that.
Cool stuff.
I always take a guess anywhere between 2 and 5 hours. The bigger ones, like the Nmap ones, those take longer.
Excellent. My question is, what kind of programs do you use to take... I'm sure you have, like, I don't know if you've stated it before, but maybe to just rehash, what kind of programs do you use to do the screen captures and then bring them into whatever program you use to do the Flash and then to mix in the sound and everything and to get that final product out?
Well, way back in 2002, I found a tool that was open source at the time called Cam Studio.
Right.
It's gone closed source since, but I'll get back into that in a second. And I thought, well, this might be useful for putting videos online or showing how to do various computer security, use various computer security tools, how to lock down your machine, and so forth. So I started producing AVIs. Then eventually I got a hold of Shockwave Flash, and I thought, well, since you can put menus in that and you can link things in it, it'd be better, and also I can make it smaller than just a regular AVI. So I started using Flash. But Cam Studio is the main tool I use. Since then, they've come out with a new version. The last open source version of Cam Studio is version 2.0. And it'll actually export straight to Shockwave Flash if you want. You can do narration and all in that. But I have more flexibility by throwing it into Macromedia Flash and adding extra stuff. I use Cam Studio for doing the raw captures. If I'm using it from Linux, what I do is I VNC it into a box, and then I capture my VNC session using Cam Studio. Some people use, I believe it's called VNC to SWF for doing the same purpose. I also use a little program I wrote myself called Squint, which basically I have all... Some video cards, they all support pretty much putting the video into 640 to 480, but a lot of them won't let you do it from the interface. You have to use an extra tool to do that. I do it in 640 by 480, so it takes up the least amount of space on the screen, so people don't have to scroll left and right if they're looking at it in a web browser. I also use Audacity for cutting the sound together. Way back when, I was using Microsoft's audio recorder, but that really sucks if you have to do anything.
Yeah.
And if you screw up, it's a major pain in the ass. So Audacity is great for that because I can chop it up however I need, and then I can the noise remover filter actually works wonders because my office where I record, I have all sorts of fans going from PCs and a refrigerator. So without Audacity to remove the noise, I'd have some serious problems. Sometimes I have to cut an AVI together, more so than just what I get out of a Cam Studio. And I use Virtual Dub for that. And that's pretty much all the tools I use. If anybody wants to use Cam Studio and play with it, there's actually a link. If you go to Hacking Illustrator from my website, there's a link about how I create the videos. And from there, you can actually download the binaries for the last open source version of Cam Studio, as well as the source code for it if you really want to pick up the project and continue it. I also recommend using their codecs because they have a lossless codec they designed that works really great for compressing screenshots.
Excellent.
And that's pretty much the tools I use for putting them together.
Very good. I mean, it is definitely just taking from what you have out there on the market, using the best of that technology and then putting that stuff together. And it,
mm-hmm. Pretty much the yeah. only thing I use that costs any... I'm pretty much using all open source software except for Flash MX. That's the only thing that I'm using that's not open source.
Mm. Yeah, it's
well, other than obviously Windows.
Yeah. Which I assume your company bought, so you didn't really pay for the license.
I didn't buy it, no.
Yeah, we'll let you off.
Now, what I work for bought it.
Cool. Yeah, that's impressive stuff, and I think you managed to get across what you need to get across, all the information in the videos. Now that brings me onto my second question, if I may. How do you handle any criticism that you get from the videos, such as content, correct, like the actual authenticity or the correctness of the information? Do you get, you know, do you get guys going, well, you know, I see how you do it, I do it this way's better, my way's better, you know, do you get any of that kind of stuff, and how do you go about handling that?
I get a little of that, not a whole lot of criticism of the technical content. Sometimes I'll get things like, oh yeah, I read how to do this, you know, so many years ago. Well, if they gave more information than I gave, I really wish they would tell me about it.
Yeah.
The number one thing people get on me about is my accent, right, and the sound quality on some of the videos, because if I don't mess the sound a little bit, I've noticed something about my particular voice, if I encode at a lower bit rate, I'm actually harder to understand.
Right.
Than if I encode at a higher bit rate. Something about, in other people's voices, it doesn't seem to be as big an issue.
Mm-hmm.
But usually people don't argue with the, don't bother me so much about the technical elements as they do possibly about the presentation as far as sound or how I string things together. You know, no indication of how long the video is and so forth was one of the complaints about the in-map video.
Mm.
And occasionally get people complaining because it seems like a big tool for script kiddies.
Right. Yeah, I don't understand that. But
did you get that much with the Metasploit Flash tutorial?
Actually, I didn't get a whole lot. Metasploit wasn't the one so much as other ones in the past, just the web page in general, people complain about, you know, I'm teaching script kiddies. Mm. The Metasploit one, though, I came out and said it. Metasploit makes something so simple that
it's absurd.
It's just trivially easy to exploit a box that hasn't been patched.
Yeah, yeah. Have you, by bringing up Metasploit, have you seen episode 13 of The Scene, which gives a flavor of what kind of stuff you do written into The Scene, by any chance?
No, I haven't, actually.
Oh, okay.
So it's episode 13 of The Scene?
That's correct. Basically, it's Drosan getting a message from some guy, you know, one of his friends, and he's like, you have to root this box, man. It's, like, critical, like, university stupid, man. You have to, like, delete these files and shit. So he goes around, talks to his hacker friend, and, you know, so he sends him to Metasploit. He, you know, gives him this thing to run, and basically he uses a shell through to wget the exploit, and then exploits that onto a server, and it basically runs through the procedure of getting the exploit, using Metasploit to execute it, and basically doesn't show you at all how to cover your ass. So basically, if you were going to do that to an actual live server for a company, you know, like some high speed, low drag shit, please don't do it, because you'll probably get a knock on your door and about 7 years in prison. It's not wise to do that at all. But if you're going to do this for your own house or for your own network or play around on your network at work, why not? You know, just give it a go, see how secure your own servers are using Metasploit.
Well, at work, you could definitely get fired.
Well, unless you were obviously the manager of IT, but yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Okay, so we don't get any lawsuits. I have to stress, you have to have written and signed consent before you do any of this stuff on somebody else's network that somebody else is paying for. Unless it's your job, obviously.
And even then, even if it is your job, sometimes you got to be careful, because if you see things that you're not supposed to see, even if it's your job to keep the network secure, there's, like, limitations. Like, no one would complain if you went to a machine and patched it. However, if you were looking at the machine for vulnerabilities, and in the process of finding vulnerabilities, let's say you sniffed your boss's password,
yeah,
or you happen to break in and install a key catcher just to see if it can be done.
Yeah.
Or if you saw documents that, like payroll documents with social security numbers and bank accounts, you could still get in trouble even if it's your job. So you kind of got to be anal retentive.
Sure.
Well, about what you do.
The way I see it is the role I'm in, there's a strict contract where anything that is done on the network in terms of network security, any gained information, is written under strict data protection, so that if I was to inadvertently get somebody else's password, anybody else's credit card number, or any kind of personal sensitive information, that would of course be covered under, you know, the Data Protection Act and all that kind of stuff. So it's all good.
So you're allowed to view that by your are you allowed to view that by your policy or not?
That's correct. Yes, I am.
Okay. Some policies. See, I work at a university, and they're a little bit different about privacy.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, if you knew someone was doing something that was causing network problems, you may not necessarily be able to look at the traffic in such a way to find out what exactly they're doing. But you can do what you can to improve network stability by possibly cutting them off the net. So that's like these fine balancing act between user privacy and securing the network and making sure everything continues to run properly.
Sure.
And sometimes you don't necessarily know where the line is.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, the way it goes with, and the way I see it, it should be, is if you employ somebody to secure your network, you have to define a contract where it states that there should be full monitoring of the network, and any traffic that goes through that network can be scrutinized. But obviously, any sensitive information contained in the traffic should not be released unless unless needed, if you see what I mean. So it's trusted between the company and the organization within their own network, seeing as they paid for the servers, they paid for the infrastructure. They've got every right to be able to monitor and secure their own stuff.
I think that's a little easier in a corporate environment than it is at like a university, though.
Yeah, true, true.
By the very nature, universities are kind of more open, and just like some, you know, student rights and so forth. So even if you know a student's up to something,
yeah,
there's limits to what you can look into to see what exactly they're up to.
Right. Okay.
If you know what I'm saying.
Well, maybe I've got a much more totalitarian view on this and more right.
So what are the policies as to you've been alerted, for instance, the amount of traffic within a certain subnet at the university is a lot higher than it normally would be, and it seems to be traffic of only one type, or perhaps with too many external IPs that can be, you know, accounted for by normal use. What would your policies be on dealing with that?
I don't understand any of that, I'm afraid.
You were very chopped
out.
Do you want to repeat that? Because you were chopping out for some reason.
Okay. I was just saying, if you notice that certain subnet... Oh, no. This is awful.
Yeah.
Hang on. I'll be right back.
Okay. I think he's having some bandwidth issues there. Basically, what he was trying to say is what would you do if you noticed that there was a large amount of activity on a subnet, and something was happening that didn't fit the standard kind of traffic flow?
Well, my particular role where I work, I probably wouldn't have to do anything.
Right.
That'd be someone else that's high up in the network ops. If it's my personal decision, if someone's causing problems with stability of the network, for instance, they're hogging all the bandwidth and no one can do external communications because one person happens to be running a BitTorrent client,
yeah,
I would kill that IP off the network, so it'd stop. However, policy being what it is, it's kind of confusing. You may be able to kill them from downloading stuff via like BitTorrent or Emule. However, you not necessarily have the ability to go onto the machine and see what they were downloading. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense, yeah.
So basically, you can generally do what you need to do to ensure the stability of the network, but this is my understanding of how things set up where I work. Luckily, it usually doesn't come down to my responsibility. You can do what you have to do to ensure the stability of the network, but you can't necessarily look at what the data is. Now, there's some weird exceptions to that. Like, let's say someone decided to host a movie on the web space,
yeah,
for their personal student web space. Well, to go in and delete that file and take it off, you're probably going to have to see what it is,
yeah,
or at least from the very file, and you're going to know what it is. So, let's just say policy might be flexible, and a lot of things are gray area. If I had those kind of issues, I generally ask someone higher up before I do anything.
Sure.
Which, yeah, slows down response time, but, CYA.
Saves your ass from getting kicked. Okay. Planet, we've been leaving you out of the questions here. Do you have any more questions to put through to Iron Geek?
Just the one, really. I was wondering if there's any upcoming new tutorials you've got in the works that you can tell us about.
Well, I have a few plans. Some stuff's real simplistic, like I was going to show how to use dynamic ports with SSH in both Windows and Linux, because that comes in real handy from time to time. I've got a project. I'm helping some ladies from around the university do videos for something called EduCause. EduCause is basically this it's a technology and higher education symposium kind of thing. And they want these I know they have a conference every year, maybe more than one for all I know. They want to get videos put together on computer security for college environments. And so I was going to help these ladies organize real simplistic 3-minute videos on topics like how to install patches on Windows in your Macintosh, how to set up the firewall that comes along with your operating system, and possibly a little bit on malware, like viruses, worms, rabbits, and so forth.
That would be good, yeah.
Now, the technical level on those ones for college students aren't going to be as high as you all might be interested in.
Yeah.
But you'll hopefully have cute women in them, so that's a big positive.
Oh, excellent. You got to hit us up with that, man.
Sold.
Yeah. Just a question to Planet, actually. Are we good for shipping for the DVDs?
Yeah, as far as I know, we're all ready to rock.
Fantastic. Cool. Yeah, because we've already sold one, so... got to get it out.
I'll get on it, mate.
Cool. Just to announce to everyone, yesterday I said I received a package which was addressed to me under my alias for some reason, and I worked out what it is. It was an application for about 50 Ubuntu CDs that I wanted, and this was like a month back. And I signed up with my alias, and obviously... I wasn't here. He couldn't go through the letterbox, so I had to go pick it up from the post office. And the guy was like, "Well, I need to see your ID." So I showed him my ID, and he's like, "Well, this is not the guy on the thing." And I'm like, "But that's my alias." And he's like, "Well, I need to see the ID of this alias." I'm like, "But it's not my legal alias." So I did a bit of social engineering, and the guy was like, "Okay, I'll have to go see with my boss." I knew that he wasn't going to go see his boss, so he just got the package. He was like, "Yeah, it's okay. Here you go." And I was okay. So, yeah. Don't ever get anything...
That's pretty weird.
Yeah. Don't ever ship anything to your hacker alias. Just ship it to your real name if you really have to. So you don't have to, bother yourself with all that.
Yeah, I found that out one time when I wrote some software and someone sent me money because they liked it.
Yeah.
But it was underneath my alias.
How did you explain that one? Iron Geek is like...
well, at the time, I was actually writing underneath a different name, but basically, I just never could cash it.
Oh, damn. That must suck.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. I think Ionix is having some network problems, so that's why he's not talking right now. But we'll wait for him to pop back on. let's see if we have any news for today. There's actually been...
I need to go to the loo. I'll be right back.
Okay, cool. See, we have a piss break from Iron Geek.
You see, I'm starting a new trend.
Yeah, exactly. I told you, man.
Catching on.
You have to patent this thing.
I'm still waiting for the corporate sponsorship to come through.
This episode has been sponsored by Pepsi Cola. Makes you
it
piss.
Makes you piss. So what do you got in the news there, mate? Because the only thing I've seen is this Linux virus type worm kind of thing.
Oh, please don't call it a virus. Please.
I saw you get funny about that in IRC, so whoops.
I did it on purpose. I mean, come on. Yeah, it's like, well, it's like ass and pussy. It's two different things. You know? God. I hate it when people go that, oh, you know, there's terrible virus when it's actually a worm, and worms are completely different than viruses because worms attack different things and they do completely different... it's completely different objective. Now, how do you like Microsoft? Well, according to a report in the Seattle Post, the Windows Defender name was already being used by an Australian developer, Adam Little. His Windows Defender product produced Windows user protected Windows users from malicious websites. Adam told the Post, Todd Bishop, that Microsoft contacted him a month ago, charging him with infringement of Windows trademark by neglecting to mention that the software giant wanted to use the Windows Defender name. Little subsequently signed over the rights to the name to Microsoft and was shocked when he later learned that the company intended to use the name for one of its own products. So, to summarize, basically what Microsoft did is they saw this guy using the name Windows Defender and thought, wait a second, we might want this name because we might want to use it for like one of our things that we're gonna like bring out one day and stuff. So we're just gonna go like, dude, you're using the name Windows, and we don't like that because like we're gonna sue you because we're like this big giant thing. And so they said, you know, yeah, you know, you can't use it. So he changed the name, and Windows took it back, signed over the rights, and now Windows is using it as their own, their product. Interesting, you know? But nothing surprising at all. I don't know if you've heard about that, actually.
I read about that earlier today.
Yeah.
But well, I'm curious, the point was made that apparently Microsoft doesn't necessarily own the rights to the term Windows, except for maybe in case it was related to software. My understanding is the guy, if he had fought it, may have had a good chance, but then again, how much would it have cost him to fight it?
Exactly. But, I mean, if he called it as in Windows Protector, it protects Windows against malicious websites, instead of saying it's Windows Defender, if you see what I mean, then I think he would have had a chance with the name. But then again, you know, Microsoft is Microsoft. The coolest thing I've seen all week is a thing called a phaser, PHASR. New Scientist reports that the US government has unveiled a new weapon that is a non-lethal laser rifle. It has many potential applications, such as temporarily blinding a suspect who drives through a roadblock. So far, the Department of Defense has declined to comment on specific details on how it works. This thing looks fucking cool. It looks like one of those things from like Deep Space Nine or something. It's like a laser rifle. I don't know if you guys have heard about that.
Yes, I have. It's awesome.
Oh, man. It looks so sexy. I'm just thinking, how much does this thing cost and how fast can I get it?
I want to know how they can make it from non-deadly to deadly.
Yeah. And how quickly. Which button is it for, like, non-lethal and lethal? Oh, it's that one. Okay, cool.
Just replace the laser in it with a CO2 laser. I'm sure that would work.
Yeah. Have you seen how that...
Oh, I'm looking at a picture.
Yeah.
I'm looking at a picture of it right now. It does look awfully cool.
Oh, it looks awesome.
No, I know the British firearm laws are much more restrictive than they are over here in the U.S., but since this isn't really technically a firearm, I wonder what the law would be considering it.
Exactly, because it's not a firearm. Yeah, precisely. I don't know.
Well, can you go about shining laser pointers at people?
I have to get back to you on that one. I would suspect no.
I know you can't in the U.S.
I would assume no, but I'll see what the law really is like if you shine the laser pointer at somebody, because this could be a really large, powerful laser pointer, and you could just walk down the street fucking shining this thing in people's eyes and blinding them for a few minutes.
I do think laser pointers were actually made kind of illegal if you shine them at people's eyes.
Yeah.
A few years back, pretty sure about it.
Yeah, that's what I'm not too sure, but I definitely think it is illegal. Yeah.
Makes me wonder though. What,
how about we convert one of these
when...
things?
Sorry.
For your audio via laser.
Yes, that would be one fucking powerful gun. Yeah. Sorry, Planet. You were saying something.
I was just wondering, though, because there was this big hoo-ha over here a while ago with laser pointers being shone in people's eyes, and they were crying out, oh, I'm blind, and, you know, laser pointers should be banned and made illegal and all that. Does that also include the special forces and the SAS who have, like, laser-guided rifles and stuff like that?
Oh, not at all, man.
You know, the red dot one things?
Not at all, man. It'd be like saying, well, you know, guns kill people, so that means that the police can't have them. Obviously, fucking, you know, laser sights on sniper rifles, that's hardly going to be a problem, because, you know, in a few milliseconds, you're going to be dead anyway, so it doesn't matter if you're blinded for like, you know... in your left eye, because this guy has, like, sneezed and shot you with it.
And I seem to recall someone a few years ago reading about someone's working on a gun that basically uses a laser beam to ionize the air between the shooter and the target.
That's right.
And then sends an electric charge down it to actually stun the person.
That's right. It's like a next generation taser that uses an ionized beam to actually transfer the electricity over. Which is fucking awesome. But it wouldn't be if you're on the other side of it, but yeah, that's another story. announcements for HackerVoice. Let's see. I'm going to join forces with rantmedia.com. And what we're going to be doing is I'm going to be hosting some of the After Now and some of the rants and possibly the latest week of Newsreel. So what will happen is we're going to host some of it on the stream, maybe even on the web server, and in turn they're going to traffic some of that traffic to us, so that they can kind of load balance and we get more traffic and more kind of audience. Let's say.
PR.
Yeah, exactly. So I've been talking to Sumerian today, which is the guy that runs Rant Media, and I'm going to be working on that probably over the weekend and over the next week.
Excellent.
Yeah. Seeing as we do have unlimited bandwidth. Oh, actually, that was another question for Iron Geek. Actually, I have two questions for you. One question is, how much do you have to pay for bandwidth, and how much bandwidth do you consume a month?
Well, the times my peak consumption, like right after I got put on Dig,
yeah,
and Hackaday, I'm not sure what it came up to because someone else was hosting it for me.
Right.
But I kept having to relocate who was hosting me because it kept sucking up too much bandwidth.
Mm.
I finally got it on my own hosting provider, and like last month I think I pushed like 200 gigs of bandwidth.
Wow.
But I get like 500 gigs in my current plan, and it costs me $7 a month.
Okay, that's not bad. That's not bad. And I see you have some links on there as well to support you. Is that like 34 cents a click or something like that, or do you get?
I don't even know if it's that much. Well, ultimately, of all the people who click, I get about like 0.01% of people who come visit my site actually click them. So
that's not a lot.
It doesn't come out to a whole much. It comes out enough to where it's a little more than it is more than I pay for the site, but I probably make about $40 a month from the site, maybe.
Right.
Maybe more like 25 sometimes.
Hmm.
It's not a whole lot.
Yeah, not a lot. And
but I figure it makes it enough to where it's not out of my pocket.
Yeah, exactly. That's where you want to have it, and that's what we're kind of trying to do now with Hacker Voice Radio, with the DVDs of Season 1, where we can sort of kind of even, the amount of money that we're putting in ourselves for hosting and Shoutcast and stuff like that. Hopefully we'll break even.
I noticed some that Google ads, though, they won't actually let me advertise on my site with them because of, the, I guess, the word hacker is all over my website.
Yeah.
And they have some weird issues with that.
Yeah, I'm not surprised.
So I currently use Canoodle, and I guess they've been working out okay. So sometimes I get weird ads, I don't know, breast cancer awareness ads or something weird like that on my webpage, and I'm like, what's the connection?
Yeah, I'm sure you get...
No one who visits my website is probably going to be clicking on those links.
I'm sure you get like loads of like, you know, secure your website against hackers, anti-hacker websites and stuff like that.
Well, I'm never trying to ask what exactly it was about my site that made it different than, say, a different website that was on security that used the word hacking.
Yeah.
And I never could get a flat answer from Google.
No, I don't think you would. I think it's because you use Nmap. Oh, man. And my second question is, how much do you really work out?
How much? Three times a week as far as weightlifting is concerned.
Uh-huh.
As far as cardio is concerned, I also try to get that on three other alternate days. I was running about 2 miles three times a week here during the summer. Since it's starting to get colder here in Indiana, I've been going to the back stairs of where I work and go up and down the stairs several times.
Wow. You're crazy, man.
You do more exercise?
Well, my natural genetics lends themselves to putting on weight. My brother is about 100 pounds heavier than I am.
Mm.
I mean, my whole I'm the smallest person in my family as far as weight's concerned. So... With my lifestyle, you know, dealing with computers and so forth, if I didn't exercise, I would blimp up again real fast. I used to be a lot bigger when I was younger.
No, exactly. No, I know what you mean. You know, you sit all day at work, and then you sit all day at night, and then you go to sleep, and then you wake up. And you
No, Belial. You sit all day at work.
Okay, I sit all day at work, and then I sit all day at night. And, I mean...
Here's a fun factoid for you.
Yeah.
I literally lifted a ton of meat today.
Wow.
When I broke down our truck, I lifted, in separate portions of course, over 2,000 pounds of meat and redistributed it throughout our cooler.
A ton of meat. Is this human meat that you've been chopping up, or...?
No, silly. This is the meat from my butcher shop.
Okay. Wow.
Mostly cow.
Ah, okay.
Good bit of chicken.
Cool. Mmm, meat. But yeah, all I do for exercise is I cycle to and from work and, you know, round about wherever I need to go, which kind of helps me keep in reasonable shape and condition. The only problem is I'm a heavy smoker, so I try and kind of even the two things out, where I can't cycle too much because I get out of breath, and I can't smoke too much because then I can't cycle. So yeah.
I found something that helped me a lot is having a refrigerator in my office. That way I can actually bring food that's good for me to eat. And if it's there, I'm not, you know, I don't get that urge to go, well, I need to eat something. I'll go out and get some fast food.
Yeah.
Because it's always more convenient for me to just eat what I brought in the fridge.
Definitely. Well, I try to kind of trick my body into thinking that it's eating something, you know, large, where I'd break down pieces of healthy fruit, like fruits and stuff like that. And then I'd eat a lot of it, but it'll be maybe like one apple, one pear, and some carrots chopped up into little bits, and then you eat that, and you think you've eaten a lot, but actually you haven't really. Yeah. It's another way to hack your diet. Yeah? Somebody was going to say something, or... No?
I just tricked my body into thinking it's eaten.
What, like through meditation, or...?
No, mostly just punching myself in the gut.
Yeah, that'll do it. It helps
reminding it that I can't afford to buy food and have to wait till I get home.
Yeah, it helps when somebody else is kicking you in the gut. Planet, do you have any useful tips on dieting with beer?
Hell no.
Guinness diet.
Yeah.
If I had any useful tips on dieting with beer, I wouldn't have a big beer gut.
You read that Atkins diet all wrong.
I read it, I got depressed and I started drinking.
Yeah. Sorry, we're talking all over you, Ionix.
Oh, no, I thought I was talking over you. there was a French monk. As a penance, he lived for an entire year on ale alone.
Really?
Yeah.
Well... Yeah, I can see that. It is like fiber and stuff, and I guess...
I think it was the really dark ale.
Yeah, like Guinness and... Yeah, I think they used to give patients that have just come out of operation a pint of Guinness, you know, to, like, boost their...
Cheers!
Yeah, boost their immune system and, like, the red blood cells and all that kind of stuff, and also the alcohol was a slight anesthesis. So, yeah. How did we get onto alcohol from, like, how much do you work out? I guess it's a natural progression. I'll never work out.
Well, nutrition's a huge part of it.
Yeah. I mean, like, do you drink and stuff? Do you, like, I know you're quite into your fitness, but do you still indulge? I don't know if
you
smoke.
Haven't seen the pictures of him and his, like, grain alcohol?
I don't...
No.
Oh, yes, you saw that, didn't you? Oh, hell. You saw the picture of Freak Nick with the bottle of grain alcohol?
No, I haven't seen it.
Oh, I only drink occasionally, but sometimes when I do drink, I drink a little too much. Tonight I've been having a stressful week because I don't have a car right now and I'm getting rides to and from work with buddies of mine. So tonight I may sit down and drink a pitcher of Guinness, but normally I don't do that. Because
sure.
Most beers and so forth, it's too much, too many simple carbohydrates and empty calories
that
aren't really a good idea if you're trying to watch your weight.
No. Yeah, it's...
My understanding, though, Guinness is not as bad as some other beers. It's supposed to have about the same number of calories per ounce as, let's say, skim milk.
Hmm.
In which case, if that is true, a 16-ounce glass would be 160 calories.
Yeah. So basically...
Well, I know what I'm putting in my cereal.
Guinness. Oh, I want to try that. Guinness with cereal.
Huh.
Cocoa Puff.
Yeah.
I had a good chocolate stout a few years ago. I imagine it might not necessarily turn out that bad. Chocolate and Guinness doesn't sound too bad at all.
Mm.
Not good for you necessarily, but it sounds like it tastes okay.
Yeah. You definitely don't want to be like eating that before you go to work. Especially too much of it. Because you come to work and you're like, oh, fucking. That's right. Now I tell you what, okay? You'd be all over the place.
I only had 3 bowls of cereal.
Only 3.
I'm not drunk.
Bowls.
Generally, I'm a pretty nice drunk. I just occasionally pick up little people and play with them like the ragdolls, though. They don't really like that much.
No. Yeah, good luck.
Little people get all upset when you do that to them.
Good luck trying to pick me up. I don't know. I'm pretty happy with my current form, my current physical form. Although I would like to lose that beer belly. Somehow I think it's going to be impossible to do because it's like one of those things that just like stay there forever. And you can never get rid of it.
There's something called set point theory, which is basically that your body gets used to being a certain weight. So if you eat a little under, a little over, your body naturally stays at that weight unless you shock your system enough to where you you reduce your calories enough and increase your exercise enough to break through that plateau.
Yeah.
The nice thing about it is, though, once you reach that certain plateau, it's also a little harder to gain the extra weight. I don't have a whole lot of scientific backing to support this theory, but it, from personal experience, it seems to be the case.
Yeah.
Like, I was locked at 215 for the longest time, and now I'm locked around 200 pounds, and it seems if I ate under or ate over, it didn't matter too much, unless I drastically changed my diet for, like, a few months period.
Sure. I find it very easy to gain weight, and very, very difficult to actually lose it, unless I'm on a strict exercise and diet regime for a good few months. Which I tend to do when I'm on holiday because I'm too poor to buy food and it's very, very hot and I walk everywhere. So that's the best time for me to lose weight is when I'm on holiday. Like if I go to Spain or something like that, I tend to lose a good few hundred pounds.
Few hundred?
Yeah, the problem is I come back through passport control and I'm all chubby in the picture of my passport and they're like, who's this guy? And I'd probably like have a different hairstyle, shave my head or something like that. So, like, I'll be black or something because I've tanned so much. That's the best way to kind of change your appearance is go on holiday for a few months and come back and you'll be skinny as fuck. Very, very dark. Yeah. Cool. Do you think you might be releasing any Linux-orientated kind of walkthroughs, like let's say for an example installing Debian or playing around with this in this kind of operating system?
I've done quite a few Linux tutorials in the past. The next one's going to involve Linux at all will probably be when I get around to doing that one on a dynamic port forwarding in a secure shell. Probably the next one I do, and sometime when I'm waiting for the next version of R to Boot CD to come out. It's called Backtrack. It's like they're combining with the team who did Wolfix to make a new live CD distribution. I'm probably going to show how to do a hard drive install of that.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, when is that coming out?
I'm honestly not sure. Last time I checked the forum, I didn't see anything that said when. But I know they're working on it.
That's going to be sweet.
Well, we're actually thinking of releasing our own Linux distribution live CD. Maybe we can get some kind of involvement with that. I guess, I don't know. We'll have to see how it goes. I don't know what kind of things you're thinking about, Ionix.
We've kind of settled into the fact that we'd like to... We'd like to make it a from the administrator standpoint, not necessarily pen testing, but more like securing the network, mapping your network for basically rogues, rogue access points, rogue intruders, maybe having an active response, scripting for use of honeypots. Basically with the idea of a live CD that could serve as an install, can be plugged into a subnet and run with custom scripting to be able to get an instant grasp of what's going on in the subnet, and being able to being able to restrict it given administrative privileges.
Yeah, that sounds pretty cool. I think the ETA for that would be maybe like 3-4 months, isn't it? Production time. You haven't really started.
I was thinking like maybe having an alpha version in a few months, probably 6 to 8 months for an actual release.
Yeah, yeah. So maybe we can.
Like the thing is, I really want this done right, you know.
Yeah, definitely. So if you're interested in Iron Geek, we could incorporate some. We can incorporate you and maybe making like a guide or how to or walk through our operating system using the different tools.
I'd be glad to help out someone on that. I can make some Shockwave flash videos for you showing how to do various odds and ends with it.
Yeah, that would be cool.
My one request on that if you could, make sure you put on drivers that would work with IPW. The IPW 2000 chipset, 2200 chipset, those are the, like, the Centrino 802.11G chipset. A lot of people put on older versions of that driver and firmware, and it works, but unless you use one of the newer ones, it won't go into RF mod mode.
Right, yeah. I think from my standpoint, I think we should include the latest drivers, and hopefully get it as stable as possible so that people can stick in their Orinoco cards. I don't know if this will be primarily focused with Wi-Fi in mind, but from what you've just said, it might just be focused primarily on wired networks and then incorporating some Wi-Fi.
Well, you know,
Wi-Fi
the thing
tools.
Is if you... It's focused on a computer on a network.
Yeah.
A computer on a network that an administrator wants to look at that network for. So there's no reason you couldn't do it in Wi-Fi. That would actually be preferable if, say, you're in an environment that is a large corporate environment or a large university environment where you're going to be going from subnet to subnet.
Yeah.
Without actually having IP routing because it's a live CD.
Mm-hmm.
To be able to look at another subnet from one,
mm-hmm.
It would be preferable to do it in the Wi-Fi because then you could just take your laptop over towards where the next segment of the thing is.
Yeah, definitely. It would be cool if we could get working drivers so that, you know, people just stick it in, it picks up the card, and you're flying, so you don't have to have the bother of just like a flavor of auditor, basically, that kind of thing. It auto
as far as the Wi-Fi goes.
Yeah, exactly. It auto configures to what you have on your machine.
I was thinking another thing that could be done with as far as driver support. If it were possible to identify the chipset, even if it did not have drivers for it, and be able to have a large database, maybe an online database of the Windows drivers.
Hmm. And then it basically pulls
for
that
those
there.
Things and automatically be able to load as a module the Windows driver into NDIS wrapper.
That would be cool. And another question for you, Ionix, is there going to be a prawn folder on the desktop? Is that a yes or a no? Or me and Planet want to know. I mean, come on.
I'm not hearing you.
I'm sorry, guys. I'm going to have to get going. Okay. Whoop beckons.
Cool. Okay, man. Thank you for joining us.
Good luck with the rest of the show.
Thank you. It was nice speaking
Thanks
to you.
Thanks for the call.
Cool. Take care.
Thanks again.
Talk to you all later.
Bye-bye. Okay. Sorry, Ionix, can you still hear us? Huh, I guess not. Let me just...
Is he crapped out?
I think he has. Never mind.
I don't know what crazy-ass software you're using to bridge Ionix in.
It's called X-Lite, but it works.
X-Lite.
Yeah, I think it's just because... I think he's having some bandwidth issues over there, so... That's basically it. Let's bring this around. If you can hear us, we can't hear you, so there's something going on. If you want to disconnect and reconnect to us, whoops, I just dropped something important, then we might try again. We're coming up to the end of the show. Let's finish it off, can I say. Do you have any more news about the sun thingy, or any more rants to go through? Because I know we kind of cut you off mid-rant last time.
When was this?
Yesterday.
I think I got it all out yesterday.
Cool.
I've actually not seen the front cover of the sun today, so... I'm just going to assume it's just as bad and just as idiotic, and I'm not even going to worry about it. Mm. But I'm going to ring those bastards up and see what they've got to say for themselves.
Yeah, definitely, we're going to have to do that. I'd like to point everybody to Friday's show this week. Friday, we're going to have a surprise guest, let's just say, for everyone. Quite interesting. I think Ionix is more qualified... more qualified to give us an introduction on this guest. It's going to be interesting. I'm excited, and I just want to thank Iron Geek again for joining us. We know you're a busy guy. I hope you enjoyed being part of Hacker Voice Radio. We hope to hear from you again.
And check out all his stuff at www.irongeek.com. There's a lot of good stuff there. That's why we wanted him on the show, because the man puts a lot of effort into these tutorials that are really very, very relevant into network security and just cool stuff in general. So check it out.
Indeed. I have acquired a few Ubuntu CDs, one which is live and one which is the installed CD. So you get two CDs. For free. If you wish to acquire one from me, send me an email or let me know that you want one at the next mid-month meeting, and I can bring that down. Talking about mid-month meeting and 2600 meetings, do you know when we'll see you next time around?
Me? Possibly the main December one.
Cool. Okay. I'll be looking forward to that. So, We're good to go with the shipping of our DVDs?
Yep.
Yeah. How many have you done so far, or is it...
None. But we're ready to go on them.
Cool. So if I say...
I've just got to do a couple of other things.
Yeah.
So early next week, we should be shipping them out.
Fantastic.
Let's say the weekend for a little bit of production.
Yeah.
Get a bit of quiet time with the printers at work when no one's around, you know. Mm. And Monday in the post, boom.
Fantastic, cool. Well, yeah. I mean, if you could send a few to me, let's say send a dozen to Ionix, and the rest for yourself, so you can distribute from you, and I'll distribute to the UK. To London. We can kind of do it like that, so I can go to 2600, sell them there, you can go to wherever you go to, or if you want to sell them directly from you. I don't know how busy you are, seeing as we're
cool.
Both working, but yeah, do expect HackerVoice DVDs to be shipping on Monday, and the sale will be next mid-month meeting and next December 2600 meeting. And we just got Ionix on the line again.
Yeah, I had to call back via my voiceover IP provider. It seems Free World Dial-Up has crapped out on me.
That's right. It was going a bit apeshit halfway through and then just completely crapping out. Never mind. Okay, so we're going to be closing off the show unless anyone has any more comments or any final thoughts.
I'm good.
How about you, Annex?
No, I'm good.
Cool. Okay, so once again, I'm going to be finishing off with a Sean Kennedy rant. This rant is about a phone in the desert. I think it's the Mojave Desert. I won't say any more about it. You're gonna have to hear what it's all about. So thank you for joining us on the episode 57, and I hope you enjoyed it. And thank you again, Iron Geek, for coming on the show. I hope the questions weren't too probing. So yeah, I'll see you all.
Thanks for tuning in.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you for joining in. I'll see you all tomorrow.
Take care. I won't be here tomorrow.
All right. Okay.
But I will be here on Friday for our interview with Phil Rosner.
Cool. Excellent. I'm looking forward to that. All right. Well, I guess it's going to be me and Planet and anyone else who decides to drop in on Skype tomorrow. So, yeah, same time tomorrow. Take care and good night.
Bye-bye.
Good night.
Ready to listen to another episode of... Whoops.
Noob!
There we go. I'm no more of noob.
...and ban things and destroy things in order to keep you safe because you're too fucking stupid to stay alive in a modern everyday culture. Oh, I'm sorry. People jump off of bridges, so we're going to make bridges illegal. Case in point. What's my point? I'm talking about the Mojave Desert payphone. Anybody remember this thing? It was a payphone in the middle of the fucking desert, which became a phenomenon. You see, a good buddy of mine was talking to me, and she said,
oh, yeah, we went down there, we checked it, it was very cool.
Well, concept, this is a payphone in the middle of fucking nowhere, okay? People could phone it, and it got on the internet with the modern media, and everybody blew it all over the world. And people were phoning this thing. They were phoning this thing from all over the planet. And there was a guy that was Desert Chad, and he was answering the phone. It was cool, drinking his Baileys and shit. It fucking ruled. And you know what? The Parks Board took it down because retarded people tried to drive out to the middle of the Mojave Desert to go to the payphone. Because they took down this modern phenomenon spectacle because people were hurting themselves because they would drive out there. They were idiots and they had no water. And therefore, they had to take it down for the good of all. For the good of all, we must destroy this phenomenon because it's too dangerous. Hey, listen, some fucking asshole's too dumb to realize if I drive out in the middle of the desert, I should bring some water or I will die. If not, natural selection in action. I don't really see a problem here, but no, we have to fucking deal with this, and I've lost that phone is gone now. It's gone. Dial tone is no longer present. You cannot make a call. What if I broke down? Now I couldn't make that call. It sucks. It sucks bad, and there's not a fucking thing you can do about it, and that's because people are not willing to take responsibility for themselves. Talk about bullshit. My name is Sean Kennedy, and I am the fucking man.